This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. This hour we'll be talking about the future of life on planet Earth. First up, are we closer than ever to a giant catastrophe that could wipe out millions of lives or even the Earth itself? That is what Professor Martin Rees, an astronomer at the University of Cambridge in England, suggests in his new book, Our Final Hour. Dr. Rees puts out an alarm directing not only scientists but also to the general public, directed at them, that unless we come together to better anticipate and control the threats posed by 21st century scientific discoveries, we might all come to a premature end. What do you think? That's what we're going to be talking about. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guest formally. Sir Martin Rees is the author of the book, Our Final Hour, A Scientist's Warning, How Terror, Error, and Environmental Disaster Threaten Humankind's Future in This Century, on Earth and Beyond, published by Basic Books. He's also the UK's Astronomer Royal and a Royal Society Research Professor and Fellow at King's College at the University of Cambridge in the UK. He joins us today by in London. Good evening to you, sir.
Good evening. Good to be with you.
Welcome back. You sound so gloomy here. Why?
Well, let me say, I'm not quite as gloomy as your introduction implies.
Okay.
In that I talk about the coming century and the risks from science as well as the opportunities, and I do think there's a high chance of a serious setback to civilization. I don't actually think we're going to wipe all ourselves out.
Right.
That's very unlikely, but I am worried that because of all the downsides of science and the fact that we have the nuclear threat continuing, there will be a risk of some setback to civilization over the next 100 years, unless we are very mindful of these concerns.
Well, you in your book, you say you've even bet $1,000 by that by 2020, and the instance of bioterror or bio-error will have killed a million people.
Yes, well, there are two parts to my book. One looks 10 or 20 years ahead, and the other looks further ahead and is more speculative. But indeed, I am concerned that in the next 10 or 20 years, advances in biotech will empower people in a way that individuals and small groups have never been empowered before to cause devastation if they wish. And I think this is something which is going to be very hard to contend with.
Is this because the knowledge is so easy to come by? And
yes, that's right. It's not like nuclear weapons, which clearly only a state can develop, but we have tremendous advances in biotechnology. They're widely known. They involve modest equipment, which, of course, exists for all kinds of benign purposes. And it's only going to take a small group of people, or maybe even an individual, to misuse this. And, of course, one can easily foresee that this could cause a serious epidemic of some kind. And I do quote in my book, a report from the National Academy of Sciences, which does indeed raise these issues as a possible worry for the next decade.
If you had to rank the worries, which worry would be on top?
Well, one genuine worry I have in the next 10 years is that there will be the use by terrorist groups or lone disaffected weirdos of biotech. This is not going to kill us all, but it's going to produce a sort of scare which is going to have a big effect on society, because we've seen recently what the effect is on society in the entire United States of the anthrax episode and the SARS episode now. And if we can imagine an episode of that kind, which was discovered to have been caused maliciously, then there'd be a realization this could happen again any time, anywhere, and it'd be very hard, without very intrusive surveillance or other measures, to stop it. And I think if this happens, it doesn't need to be a scare that directly kills huge numbers of people for it to have a very severe corrosive effect on society.
So you're not talking about something that accidentally sneaks out of the laboratory, or a virus that accidentally escapes, maybe an Ebola or something like that.
Well,
talking
of course,
about
there are threats of that, I suppose, yes. Yeah. But I'm not an expert, and I've got tremendous confidence that the people who do this sort of thing are extremely cautious.
Now, why at this point in your career, and you're probably the most preeminent astronomer in the world, why And I'm reminded even Carl Sagan, the late Carl Sagan, another astronomer in this country, was driven to write Pale Blue Dot, the book about the Earth being as vulnerable as it is. What is driving scientists like you to step out and become very vocal about things like
that? Well, I should say I do, in my book, discuss some issues about the future of life on and beyond the Earth. Mm-hmm. In the spirit of Sagan, but it's not a new concern of mine. Over my career as a researcher and university teacher, I have taken an interest in arms control. I've written articles on that subject, mm-hmm. and I've given many talks, and also on the social responsibility of scientists, etc. And I felt I got enough material to draw them together into a book. So I really felt that the points I make in the book do need to be made, and I think it is the obligation of us as academic scientists to raise the level of discussion, because we are talking about the opportunities of science and how we can harness these and at the same time avoid the downsides. And this requires the public to be aware of both the opportunities and the risks, and to decide which doors should be opened, which doors should be left closed.
Sir Martin, are you then saying that scientists should stop what they're doing and consider the possibilities that might happen?
I'm not saying they should stop what they're doing, but I am saying that they should have a concern to ensure that the wider public knows the potential and the risks of what they're doing, and they should have a social concern with how their work is applied. Of course, most of the research that's done in universities is applied by other groups of people in industry and elsewhere. It's not under the control of the researchers, but the researchers should still be concerned. Rather like you may not be able to control what your grown-up children do, mm-hmm. but it's a rather poor parent who isn't concerned about what happens to them. Similarly, if you've had some scientific ideas, then you ought to be concerned that they are used wherever possible for good and to avoid their harmful use. And I do in my book have a chapter expressing my admiration for some of the outstanding physicists who were involved in producing the atomic bomb and who after the war did maintain a prolonged concern with arms control efforts. I'm thinking of people like the great Professor Hans Bethe at Cornell University, Joseph Rotblat in my own country, the UK, who have been throughout their life concerned to ensure that the work which they were involved in should be used minimally for humanity's harm.
See, you must be alarmed when you hear, for example, James Watson say, "If biologists won't play God, who will?"
Well, indeed, I quote him in my book, not entirely approvingly. I do feel that in biology, one needs to be somewhat cautious, and one should be cautious not only because we don't know exactly what the outcome would be, but also because there's something I discuss called the yuck factor, which mm-hmm. is just an intrinsic distaste we have for certain applications of science that we think are unnatural. So I do think that we need to talk among the wide public about what should be done in science. It's not for scientists to decide how their work should be applied, but the public needs to understand enough science to participate in the debate. And there's another thing, since you mentioned Watson, which is another reason why the coming century is going to be more unpredictable and perhaps more hazardous than any century before. And that is for the reason Watson mentioned, namely that for the first time, human beings themselves can be changed. Over the last thousands of years, human beings have been the same in their character and their physique, but even that may start to change. So that's another dimension of change in our Earth over and above those due to nuclear, nano, cyber, and biotechnology.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to imagine that scientists from around the world might organize themselves into bioethics committees, things like that? Is that what you're looking for?
Well, sometimes it should be organized, and of course one benign feature of the publicly funded Human Genome Project was that there was a special item in the budget to organize just such committees, and there's been a great deal of excellent work done there. But I also think that we scientists as individuals have an obligation to explain what we're doing to the wide public and to alert the public to concerns, and also, of course, to promote all the benign applications of our work. Mm-hmm.
Of course, you remember, I'm sure, the Asilomar conference back in 1974, Asilomar being a little town in California, where scientists stopped to this new field of genetic engineering, gene splicing, to talk about the consequences.
That's right. Jim Watson, in retrospect, thought that was a mistake, but others involved thought it was a good precedent. It showed that scientists could impose a moratorium on themselves. I think actually it will be harder to do that now because of the greater commercial pressures and the much larger scientific community than there was at that time. So I think it's going to be very hard to impose a sort of moratorium because of the competition and the international competition, because it's not just the US and Europe, it's Singapore and China and other places which are engaged in these endeavors.
How do you go about getting the public in on a discussion like this, seeing that so little of the media knows how to translate a lot of science to them?
Mm-hmm. Well, that was one reason I wrote my book, because the book, I hope, is accessible to non-scientists, and it does at least raise some of these issues. And I think that it's very valuable that the public should be aware of more of science's opportunities and also of the ethical issues and the social issues which are raised about how we apply our work to the greatest benefit.
What's your take on genetically modified foods? I know in Europe it is just about, it's abhorred, while over here people don't think very much about it.
That's right. It's interesting. I think there are specific reasons. I mean, we have a sort of smaller scale ecology in our fields than you have in your great prairies, etc. Mm-hmm. So I think there are some objective reasons for the difference. But my personal view is that it is right that there should be a public discussion, and that the public should be reassured before anything that is qualitatively new is done. I personally would bet very strongly that there's no severe downside, but I think it is right to do what we are doing in this country, in England, and have a public discussion and debate before we authorize these things.
How about our helter-skelter love affair with technology and high technology? You write a little paragraph in Chapter 2 is called Technology Shock, and it says a super-intelligent machine could be the last invention humans ever make.
Yes. Well, there, of course, I'm looking more than 20 years ahead, and I should emphasize how uncertain these speculations are, because if you look back to 1900, people would not have predicted nuclear weapons, and certainly things like mobile phones would have seen magic. And so we have a hard job predicting. But, of course, many people, more expert than myself, have predicted that machines may achieve human capabilities. I think they'll certainly achieve human capabilities in processing power, but of course the question is, can they relate to their environment and actually react to the outside world in a way that allows them to behave as though they're intelligent? Mm. Because at the moment, as we know, computers can do many things better than us, but a computer can't distinguish a dog from a cat in a way a three-year-old child can. So they've got a long way to go in the software before that happens. But I think, as many other people have realized, that by the year 2030 or 2040, then there may be computers which can actually perform intellectual tasks which we would normally regard as human creativity, and also, of course, help us in other ways. And some people do worry that this could get out of control. And indeed, I say that this may be the last invention that humans need ever make, because once you've got a super intelligent computer, then it can make an even better one more easily than we can. And so takeover. But here we're in science fiction.
We've run out of time. I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
To you. Sir Martin Rees, author of the book Our Final Hour, A Scientist's Warning, How Terror, Error, and Environmental Disaster Threatens Humankind's Future in This Century. Of course, he is the astronomer, British Astronomer Royal, and he joins us. He joined us from the UK. Thank you for taking time to talk with us this hour.
Thank you very much.
We're going to take a quick break, and then we talk some more about gloom and doom. So stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're now going to turn to another view of the end of the world. Sounds like, really, it's a Friday afternoon. We're talking about gloom and doom, but this is an interesting, more natural look, perhaps. My next guest, because they're an astronomer and a paleontologist, two naturalists who are suggesting, and they're thinking of Earth's lifespan in terms of a clock. Okay, look, think of your clock face now. Each hour on the clock represents 1 billion years in the life of our planet. Now, the first signs of life appear about 1 o'clock. The age of plants and animals begin at 4 o'clock. So right now it's about 4:30, and Earth is middle-aged. And the end of the world, they say, will come at about 12 o'clock when our dying sun expands so much that it engulfs our 12-billion-year-old planet. That's not going to happen for a while, because we've only been in our planet. That's going to be a few billion years in advance, but let's talk about how we get there and what's going to happen in between. How much will the actions of we humans alter the natural course of things? That's what we'll be talking about for the rest of the hour. So if you'd like to join our discussion, give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my guests. Don Brownlee is a co-author of The Life and Death of Planet Earth, How the New Science of Astrobiology Charts the Ultimate Fate of Our World, published this year by Times Books. He's also a planetary scientist and a professor of astronomy at the University of Washington in Seattle, and he joins us from member station KUOW in Seattle. Welcome to the program, Dr. Brownlee.
Thank you.
You're welcome. His co-author is Peter Ward, a paleontologist and professor of Earth and Space Sciences and Zoology at the University of Washington in Seattle. But he's joining us today from Hawthorne, Nevada, where he's collecting fossils. Welcome back, Dr. Ward.
Ira, it's great to talk to you.
You running around on the ground there with your brush or something, or you got your grad students doing all that for you?
No, we're the guys. We're in just the funkiest motel in the world, and we're just about to head out and start looking. Actually, we're looking for asteroid fragments.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, we're trying to see what caused one of the great mass extinctions.
Well, is there another mass extinction headed our way in the life and death of planet Earth?
Well, I think we're certainly in one at the moment. If we look at the rate at which species have disappeared in the past, what's happening to the biosphere now is every bit as catastrophic, if we continue it, of course, for the next few centuries, as anything that's happened in the past.
Mm-hmm. Now, you call the whole process that we're going on here in something called devolution. Give us an idea of what's going on. Why do you call this devolution?
Well, we in your clock analogy, we'd like to point out that, you know, that's pretty comforting to think that we've got another 7 billion years. But the clock analogy also tells us that we're really halfway through the age of animals. And while life will not be extinct on the planet, having an entirely bacterial planet is of very little interest to me, good animal that I am. And the age of animals is half over. So if we're at 4:30 on the clock, at 5 o'clock, animals are totally out. Now, once that happens, this tree of life, and again, it's been very comforting that all science is telling us there have been more and more and more species through time. I mean, this is, you know, it's like we're getting richer and richer, except that has to peak and start going downward. And a lot of the new studies suggest that we are on the downward leg. I'm a middle-aged man, and believe me, I know what that downward leg is like, and the planet may be doing the same thing.
Now, Donald Brownlee, how do we know that this is happening?
Well, yeah. It's interesting. The driver of many of the changes, long-term changes for Earth, are just the brightening of the sun. All stars slowly get brighter in time. The sun, that's what's called a main sequence star, which spends 90% of its lifetime burning hydrogen into helium. It sort of doubles over that time. It gets about 10% brighter every billion years. Now, towards the end, it gets thousands of times brighter when it's a red giant. But just as a normal sun-like star, it just slowly gets brighter. And the Earth has been able to adapt to these brightness changes so far. But with the next half a billion or billion years, even though the temperature really won't be that much hotter on Earth, because the sun will only be 5% brighter, it actually changes Earth's systems and changes the atmosphere. And the primary thing it does that causes the end of the animals and plants is it basically, the increasing heat of the sun causes chemical changes on Earth that draws practically all of the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. But what about, Peter, this idea you said that our half-lifetime is over? Why can't we go on forever? How do you know this is going to happen?
Well, we have a pretty good clue, and again, Don hit upon it. You know, it's so ironic in this day when global warming is scaring everybody, and carbon dioxide, of course, is the chief culprit in global warming, that we should be worrying not about too much global warming, but in the long term, too little global warming. Well, too little carbon dioxide is going to really cause photosynthesis to stop, and once you stop having plant life, you stop having animals. Yeah, there will be nothing but carnivores.
What year is this going to happen so I can sell my stock before that? What are we talking about here? Give us some idea of what year that too little carbon dioxide is going
to
happen.
The models suggest to us, again, that we're halfway. We have a Cambrian explosion 500 million years ago when animals started, and we are exactly halfway to the end. So we've got another 500 million years, and there will not be another animal on this planet. So what the implication to us is not so much about Earth, and it's obviously we live on Earth, so we're most importantly interested in it, but what about other habitable planets? And what we've tried to do in this book is examine the life cycle of planets, and they're all going to act in a similar fashion, we believe.
Mm-hmm. What about in the short term in terms of global warming? Shouldn't we be worrying about that?
I would be very worried about it. We at the university heard an address about a month ago from a guy named Dave Battisti who does climate modeling, and he and others have come to the conclusion that the physics of some of our best climate models is totally wrong. And the way he got at this was looking at Washington State, the distribution of crocodiles and palm trees 40 million years ago. Now, if you live in Seattle like I do, the idea of having palm trees in Seattle is a very nice thought. We've had a brutal cold spring. But it's coming at us. It's going to come at us, according to this guy, within 200 years, we could expect the same sort of temperatures to produce the ability for palm trees to live in Washington State and crocodiles to re-inhabit it. That's a really rapid change.
On the other hand, you talk about this phenomena that where the Gulf Stream is going to change its course and make it brutally cold in the Atlantic, North Atlantic areas, and bring back the ice age.
This is the scariest of scenarios, of course, is that increased global warming could somewhat paradoxically dip us back into an ice age. And people are going back and forth and forth and back about this. And our models, again, they're flawed. We cannot predict if ever-increasing heat is going to cause us to get really hot, or the distribution of moisture up to the Arctic cools it down to the point that we start going back into ice age. Mm-hmm. So either way, it's kind of a no-win situation. Personally, I'd rather have it warm than cold. The ice age is the biggest disaster of all.
Hmm. Yeah, I think an insight on this is by looking at the planet as a whole over its entire 12-billion-year lifetime, you see that we are not a stable planet. It's under constant change, both on short-term and long-term processes. We can't probably have much influence on the long-term changes, but we actually can have hopefully positive and certainly negative changes on the short term. But by knowing that the Earth is not going to take care of us, I think we need to realize that we need to do everything we can to try to maintain the wonderful environment that we have. The Earth is a wonderful planet, best one we know of, and we actually live here in a really good time in its history.
Do you foresee any way we could reverse climate change?
Yeah, well, actually, the long-term problems probably can be ameliorated by technology. Again, as we lose carbon dioxide over the long period, we have all that carbon dioxide is simply tied up in limestones, rock on the Earth's surface. Through engineering, we could globally engineer this planet to live longer, just as we in our lifetimes, by changing diet, increasing exercise, and doing all that hard stuff, can make ourselves live longer. We, as planetary engineers, can find solutions to make our planet live longer. You can never put off death, but you can certainly increase the habitability and the livability by engineering.
Mm-hmm. Another fascinating part of your book talked about the return of the supercontinent, where we used to have that giant continent hundreds of millions of years ago. You say it's coming back.
Yeah, this is exactly what I'm doing at the moment. I'm in Nevada looking at Triassic rocks, and Triassic was really the dawn of the age of dinosaurs. At the end of the Triassic 200 million years ago, we had this enormous mass extinction. We had an even bigger mass extinction 250 million years ago, and it really now appears that neither of these was caused by asteroid impact, as we thought even 2 years ago. What it looks like is we had the sudden emission of enormous amounts of methane, that's swamp gas, into the atmosphere, causing very rapid global warming that killed off over half of all species. And this, to me, is frightening. because we're now seeing these two past global catastrophes as being caused by sudden global warming on about the same scales that the humans are doing to the atmosphere now.
Are you saying that that meteorite theory is now passé? Killed the dinosaurs off?
No,
the dinosaurs were certainly killed by a meteor, but there are five major mass extinctions. Only one appears to be caused by a meteor impact. The other four are caused by the Earth itself, and this goes right back to what Don was saying. The Earth is an unstable system, and it goes out of whack to the detriment of its animals and plants with some regularity.
Well, would it be better that we get out of this place to someplace else? Would that be easier than trying to rejigger the planet?
No. Where can we go, Ira?
Well, Mars looks good, you know?
Mars looks bad.
Believe me, you would not be happy to be on Mars. Mars is a wonderful planet, but you wouldn't be happy to live there. There's nothing to eat. There's no...
Can't breathe.
No water, no power.
It's easier to fix it if it's busted than to go some other place.
But it's easier to Mars.
I think one point about our book is that people, should appreciate the planet that we live. A lot of people think that, well, when times get tough, you just pick up and go somewhere better, but there may not be many places better. There certainly aren't any places that are better in our solar system, and the Earth, both better in terms of place and in time. You know, we as humans probably wouldn't have been very happy even to live 100 years ago, and we might be better in the future, but not in the near future, but not in the long-term future, because the Earth's environments will degrade to the point where we will not be able to live, even with protective environments around it, such as submarines and refrigerators and so forth. People live in some pretty nasty places on Earth right now.
Yeah.
So we can be adaptive, but we can't beat nature in the long run.
What's going to make it so inhospitable to life? What is driving that?
Well,
the loss of oxygen, the loss of carbon dioxide for heat, oxygen.
Well,
there are
a whole series of events that happens as the sun gets brighter in time, and it causes the Earth's biological and physical systems to break down. The first really, really major catastrophe is when the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere drops below the critical level for photosynthesis. So that's the end of plants and the end of vegetarians, basically. And as you go on to the more distant future, believe it or not, we lose our oceans. And actually, for any kind of life to survive on Earth, we actually have to lose our oceans. If the Earth doesn't, it'll become actually much worse than Venus in terms of surface temperature. The surface of the Earth would get so hot that the mountains would melt, literally. But the ocean, within a time scale of a few to 3.5 billion years, will be lost to space. And we will become a planet that, if foreign alien astrobiologists were looking at the sun and looking for Earth-like planets, they might see a planet at our distance from the sun, but it was a pinkish, reddish color with no water, and say, well, that's not an Earth-like planet. In fact, it was the Earth, but just in the future.
Let's go to the phones. A lot of people would like to talk to you. Let's go to Rick in Phoenix. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi there.
Hi. I was just calling about asteroid impact. It's kind of funny that you guys are talking about that, but my point is, it seems to me that that's a fairly large risk that we face, and there's not a lot of resources that we really have to throw at it to help ourselves some on it. So
why worry about the end of the Earth? Natural causes, we're going to get hit by a big one.
We're going to get us all here.
That's a great point. Let me address that. The people that have funded me on this trip, and I'm here with actually a great geologist from the University of Arizona, David Kring, who's probably the world's expert on the effects of asteroid impact and in the geological record. We are trying to track down whether this big mass extinction was caused by impact. We really need to know, and NASA is funding this because NASA wants to know, what is the risk from impact in outer space? And in our lives, there are two fates, aren't there? There's fate one, the one we all want. We live to a ripe old age, happy, healthy, handsome, and then we die in our sleep quickly, nicely. Fate two is we get hit by a bus. And those are the two same possibilities. We live to a ripe old age, a planet that finally loses its habitability in its oceans, or we are hit. Let's say that we've been hit by Comet Hale-Bopp in 1996. This planet would be sterilized. That comet was so large, the velocity is so great, it would have sterilized planet Earth, and we have to think about it because, as the caller correctly points out, it's a huge risk.
We're talking about life and death of Planet Earth on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News with the author of the same book of the same title, Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee. A very interesting, highly readable book, not only about the death, but how plants live. You know, this is we talk about this a lot on this program, that hardly anybody's paying attention to this. You know, we talk about things that might occur, but if you look at the history of our solar system, this is going to happen sometime. But there's very little talk or action taken, besides studying it some more, you know?
Well, one thing that really struck us is when we wrote this book, we realized this is actually the first book about the long-term history of future of the planet. And so as people, you know, we're thinking about the present, and we think about the past, but very few people actually seriously think about the long-term future. But, you know, as astrobiologists, it's very important to consider the full life history of planets, because as we look out at other planets like Earth, you know, we're going to see it in all different stages of its lifetime. It looks like looking at a forest. You see little trees and medium-sized trees and big trees and dead trees. And they're all trees, but they're in different parts of their life cycle. And if we visited Earth at random times during its 12 billion year full history, most people wouldn't recognize it at many of its random times. For instance, for most of 90% of Earth's life, there would be no visible life. There's bacteria, but those are invisible creatures to the naked eye. So Captain Kirk, you know, landing on Earth all the time, you know, 100 times during its history, is only about 10 times out of that 100 landings would he see anything remotely similar to what we consider Earth today. So we're highly biased by our little place in time.
Beam me out, Scotty. It's dead.
Well, there might be Earth deep underwater. There might be life deep underwater in these places.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But nothing that we would want to, you know, take home and fry up that evening.
Well, yogurt's nothing. Good to eat. Bacteria's okay. You know, I like my yogurt, but otherwise, not much to eat.
But you'd like to rent a video every now and then. So,
one of the books that influenced us was, and this sounds depressing, but it isn't, the great bestseller, How We Die by Sherwin Nuland. And all of us, again, have to face that hurdle. We are going to die, each of us. And we decided, let's try that approach for planets. And let's examine planets now and just try to demystify and make it unemotional in the sense that this is a life cycle. And we used in a book, my mother passed away, and this was a very sad event in my life, and the way she passed away in old age is how planets seem to pass away, is the systems are interlocked. Mm-hmm. And when they start failing one by one, the planet radically changes.
All right, we're going to take a short break and try to think of happier things on this Friday so people can come back and talk more about the life and death of planet Earth. So stay with us. We're talking with Peter Ward and Donald Brownlee, authors of The Life and Death of Planet Earth, and take more of your phone calls. So don't go away. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note. Join Neil Conan on the next Talk of the Nation for a look at the return of American troops from Iraq. What can troops expect as they come home? We're talking this hour about the end of the world as we know it. Hopefully it's not going to happen real soon, so stay with us. We'll talk more about it with my guest Peter Ward, paleontologist and professor of Earth and Space Sciences and Zoology at the University of Washington in Seattle, and Don Brownlee, planetary scientist and professor of astronomy at the University of Washington in Seattle. And they have a new book out from Times Books called The Life and Death of Planet Earth, How the New Science of Astrobiology Charts the Ultimate Fate of Our World. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Now, Donald, I understand that there's an accelerated sort of devolution happening in the Hawaiian Islands, correct?
Well, you mentioned just before the break about how this is a little bit of a depressing subject. And we actually, maybe Peter and I have gotten into this so much that we don't think it's depressing at all. It's understanding nature. Yeah. And I think one of the most exciting things we can do as humans is to understand our place in the cosmos and how nature works. You know, we benefit greatly, for instance, by knowing that the Earth is not flat, even though many people in the past have lived and died believing that the Earth is flat. So we should understand the natural history of our planet. And, you know, the planets are complicated things, but we can understand the natural history of our Earth and also more regional areas. And a really good analogy to this whole thing is the Hawaiian Islands. You know, people go to Hawaii and everybody loves it. And no one that goes there says, oh, my God, this is just terrible. because I'm on a dying island. You know, within 2 or 3 million years, this island will sink beneath the sea, and all these palm trees and wonderful birds and so forth will all be gone. But in fact, the Hawaiian Islands do. They form above the ocean. They drift up to the northwest. And with it, just a few million years, they're gone. And all those wonderful things on the island that, you know, couldn't swim over to another island or fly off somewhere, go down with the ship. And habitable planets that form close enough to a star to be warm enough to have liquid water in the ocean also have a life cycle. They have a time in the sun, if you will, when they can be what they are.
Right.
And eventually those things degrade. So we should view this not in a negative term, in that billions of years from now it's all going to be over, but that nature has provided this fantastic place that we live, mm-hmm. and we can't understand all of it, but we can understand a lot of it. And to me, as a scientist, it makes me appreciate the Earth and our environment even much more, you know, seeing it in a sort of a planetary scale, both in terms of mm-hmm. space and time.
All right, let's go to Fort Lauderdale, Florida, to Brandon. Hi, Brandon. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, how's it going?
Hi there.
I just first wanted to say I just got done reading your book, and it was a fantastic book. I'm a biologist, and I absolutely loved it. It's the first book of its kind that I've read, and I thought it was fantastic. And my question is, pretty simply, if our planet's going to die, is there a chance that humans are going to be able to get off it and survive in the long run at all?
Yeah, let me give a shot at that. One of the interesting things about this book, and our book is a follow-up of our book Rare Earth, in which we were trying to look at how frequent animals might be in the universe. And coming from that, Don probably knew, but I didn't, is what an sort of unrepresented, in terms of stars, neck of the galaxy we live in. We're in a neck of the galaxy where stars are pretty far apart. Were we in the center, there'd be a lot of them. Now, the nice thing about being in our part of the galaxy is we avoid an awful lot of the really bad cosmic catastrophes. Very few supernova. We're not going to get obliterated by cosmic ray jets. Gamma rays aren't going to fry us. And we've got lower asteroid impact. But the bad news is, because we live in this safe neighborhood, unfortunately, we're in like a very rich neighborhood. The houses are very far apart. Now, it's easy to talk about faster-than-light drive. It's much harder to develop it. Are we going to be able to produce giant spaceships where generations of humans pass, generation after generation after generation, between our star and the next star? And once you get there, no way of knowing if there's any place you can live. That's our fate if we're trying to get off the planet.
Mm-hmm. All right, Brandon?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling.
It.
Give us a scenario about the ice age coming. Is that going to be a fast thing, a slow thing? Can we, you know, can we melt the stuff, or what's going to happen to it?
Well, the best record we have is from the ice cores, and scientists we know for several decades have been taking cores and examining how rapidly climate change can take place. And within 20 years, you can have radical and radically changing cooler climates. We are in an ice age. The ice age has been, for the last 2 million years, 90,000 years of ice and 10,000 years of non-ice. We've just gone through the 10,000 years of non-ice. During the ice, the planet is cooler and drier. Now, the scary thing is that during that cool and dry, you would not be able to raise the great grains and cereals that keep humans alive. Were we to go into an ice age, we would have a rapid population reduction through starvation. It is the scariest of scenarios.
And does that mean we have these mile-thick ice sheets that come down like they did last time?
Yes.
How far south would they go?
Well, you're in New York City. You'd be under the ice.
I've seen the marks in Central Park already, from the last one. I know Long Island was formed by two glaciers.
Yeah, no, it would be disastrous for societies. We know it. And how's this for a tiny little aspect of the disaster? We couldn't fly jets. During ice ages, there is so much fine particulate matter, it's like the volcanoes going off, except it's all over the planet with these great winds. We couldn't fly a jet plane during the ice age.
Do you think that would be the least of our worries?
Well, it's the one that strikes me, because we all fly jets.
Well, if I got a mile of ice sitting on top of me,
I want to get out of here with a damn jet plane.
Would it come from both ends of the poles?
Yes,
it would come up from both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this wouldn't cause the end of humans. I mean, we survived the last ice age. We'll certainly survive it again.
But in what form would we survive?
But, well, hopefully not in caves like we did last time.
Well, why not? But if we're wiping out all that stuff or the
technology? Well, I mean, people are pretty adaptable. I was on the Big Island of Hawaii about a year ago, and I was struck by the fact, you look at the map and the ages of these flows coming down the mountain, you think, oh my God, this island, it's being covered with lava. And yet, you know, some people get their houses buried, and a couple years later, someone builds another house on the same flow. If things happen slow enough, even on timescales of decades, people are very adaptable. But it will be a huge stress on civilization, and certainly certain countries more than others. Canada will be covered with ice, and so where, you know, it's a problem we've never had before. Where are the Canadians going to go? Are they going to come down and live with us for 90,000 years? Or
what about
Mexico?
The Europeans? They're going to be.
I don't know.
Europe will be totally covered in ice.
They can head down towards the southern part of Europe, but. These are huge questions, and something is going to happen. The last 10,000 years has been a time of actually quite remarkable calm, the time since the invention of agriculture. And this has been a time that's been rather peculiar in the last few million years. So we can't expect the Earth to naturally provide the climate as stable as it has been during the time of civilization.
I got to ask you this question because, you know, scientists can't even predict next week's weather. So which parts of your scenario are the most unsure? Have the least, as they say, significance in the predictions? What would
Go ahead, Peter.
Needs more study? Peter, you want to answer that?
Yeah, the funny thing is that the sooner it is, the closer it is, the less the certainty. The farther away we look, the more certain things become. We can really predict carbon dioxide drawdown. We can predict the sun. And even over that long a period, we can predict the relative flux of asteroid impact. I'm looking out my window now. I see David Kring, who's really this tremendous student of the planetary bombardment. And we, over the long time, can predict that over the next 100 million years, we should expect to have another Chicxulub, that's the dinosaur killer, sized impact on the Earth based on the flux. And that, by the way, is another scary scenario.
Now, how do you motivate people to do something about that?
Well, it's the excitement, certainly, of knowing that it might happen. And again, the other aspect is use our own lives as a goal. If we sit around and eat cheeseburgers all day, we're going to die a early death. If we smoke all the time, we're going to die an early death. And so you convince people, quit eating cheeseburgers and quit smoking, and their lifestyle increases and improves. And that's what we can do with this planet.
We're talking about the life and death of planet Earth this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Did I step on someone's toes there? Let's see. Oh, not yours, of course. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get in one more phone call from the city by the bay. John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Hi, great show. Here's my question. If we know that the Earth is going to be getting hotter, which would then cause depletion of carbon dioxide, is there any consideration in your book to some sort of massive engineering project that would harness something such as electric propulsion, which would then increase the Earth's orbit away from the sun, which would then equalize the amount of flux that we get, hence staving off the effects of a hotter sun?
Don?
Yeah, we actually talked about an interesting paper in Nature magazine two years ago. This was a proposal to move the Earth. So as the sun gets brighter, you just move the Earth away from the sun.
I've seen that Twilight Zone already.
So maybe we can do that kind of thing. Maybe not. It's easier to write stories about that than it is to actually do. I am a space scientist, and I work with spacecraft, and I'm more impressed how difficult it is to do grand things than write about them. But
what about keeping the sun?
But even if we could, if we develop the technology to do this, and this technique had a comet that would encounter Earth every 6,000 years and transfer energy from Jupiter and Saturn to Earth and move it out. But, you know, maybe even if we could do that, there are fantastic risks, you know, like we would be likely to have our moon crash into the Earth, which we know would not be good. And even if we get out to where, ultimately we get out to where Mars is, you've got to get rid of Mars, because if Mars hits the Earth, is even vastly worse than getting hit by the moon. So it's like making rain, you know. If you make rain, you might make things better, you might make things worse. And so people are very skittish about making rain. Moving plants and so forth would be a really grand planetary engineering project. and something would have a risk beyond anything we've ever known in the past, because it could extinct every living thing on the planet.
Well, in the minute or so that we have left, how could we rejigger the Earth here? What would we have to do in order to survive?
Probably the easiest thing for us to do is to mess with carbon dioxide, and we have to, as a society, the biggest danger facing us right now is runaway greenhouse gases. We, as a society, maybe Washington should walk over to Kyoto and sign those accords. Personally, we have to act as a global civilization. I mean, that's the absolute imperative here. These problems are not affecting one city-state or another. It's a global problem. Only global engineering will solve these problems. Our first greatest risk, global warming. After that, a return to glaciation. We're going to have it sooner or later. We have to make sure that doesn't happen. After that, we have longer-term problems. It has to be done. You know, the one thing, Ira, that really strikes me as a paleontologist, the average longevity of most species is about 5 to 7 million years. We've been around for 200,000. Even if we're average, we have another 6 million to go. That's a long slice of time.
Mm-hmm. Can we actually stave off the glaciers?
I think so.
How?
All you have to do is increase carbon dioxide, keep the glacier. We've got to balance CO2.
Yeah. Well, it's all locked up in the limestone. You're saying we just take it out of the limestone that way?
Yep. All you have to do is heat limestone, and out comes carbon dioxide.
Well, it sounds pretty simple. Everybody in their backyard barbecue, we heat some limestone?
Well, the trouble with government projects, we always see how they always have their own little twist at the end, don't we?
Yeah, and unfortunately... Yeah, well, one risk of this is that we are living on the experiment. So it's too bad we don't have another planet to play around with. No, I think just philosophically, you know, I think it's very important that we study and understand the long-term evolution.
Right.
But of course, we don't know that we can affect that, but we can seriously affect the short term, and that's the time that we live in.
For better, so I
think understanding both long and short-term things is just absolutely fundamental to being good stewards on our planet and living here. Something we should all do.
All right. I couldn't agree more. We've run out of time. I'd like to thank my guest, Don Brownlee, planetary scientist, professor of astronomy, University of Washington in Seattle, and Peter Ward, paleontologist and professor of Earth and Space Sciences and Zoology, also at the same place, and also authors of The Life and Death of Planet Earth, How the New Science of Astrobiology Charts the Ultimate Fate of Our World. Thank you, gentlemen.
Ira, thank you.
Have a great weekend. Earlier, we spoke with Martin Rees of King's College, University of Cambridge in United Kingdom. Kevin Waite is our technical director. Our audio engineer is Matt Galick in New York. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Keith Maleski and Alphonse Vinn. And if you'd like to send mail, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where you'll find all the links we talk about on Science Friday. Send us email. Also, you can listen to Science Friday on the Real Audio or download it on your Audible player. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.